Thanks very much. Hello, everybody. It's lovely to be here. I'll do the tall man thing and adjust it. Adjust the mic. I'm going to read is called Cyrano de Bergerac, and many of you know that legendary French character, the guy with the long nose who has the gift of a silver tongue, but not the physical attributes to put it into practice, to turn his hand to romantic pursuits. But he finds his niche advising other men, handsome, inarticulate men in particular. And so this is the story of Cyrano de Bergerac transported to the west of Ireland. I've written a fair few wedding speeches in my time, mostly for men I don't really know, celebrating brides I've never met. I'd have a bit of a name in the town. Last night in Kennedy's kitchen, myself and Kennedy crafted a few one-liners about his fiancé's people. For my trouble, he let me smoke. He fed me beer. He drank tea himself. Kennedy's looking forward now to standing up at the wedding table in that furnace of popularity. If he gets it right, he'll smoothly praise the mother-in-law's cooking. I've left him a few ideas on evoking her worried genius. He'll go on to tackle the father-in-law's austerity with a GAA jibe. But the issue of the bride's beauty needs some work. What he described from the heart, but unromantically, as her focus in life, her diligent nature, won't do. "Don't say that," I said sternly. "I'll think of something else and I'll text it to you. Have you a story about the first time that you met her?" With Kevin Howley's speech, that's what we did, and it went down a bomb. They can't get enough of that. The courtship is key. Remember, the wedding is the end of the courtship, so you have to give them a sense of something monumentally sweet. A thing dying and expanding in that very moment. Speak to create immersion. The big meal and the dancing are like the great machine of an absolutely poignant destiny. Gastrically oiled, fueled by the sincerity and daftness of herds of relations, be aiming for tears. Always aim for tears. "Feckin' hell," said Kennedy. "A man I know to be unfaithful. You should go pro with this stuff." I was embarrassed, then vexed. "Get a bloody website up and running. This is gold," he said. He jotted, and I talked, partaking in my way as I drank the free cans of his bride, of their odd, sumptuous joy. I saw myself floating into the hotel. A troop of buxom staff scooping vegetables saw me as a colleague. I said, "Wedding audiences are a doss." Kennedy scribbled in his new kitchen. On leaving, I received fag money. A fiver in coins, €8 something. My gift to him was declining my invitation. I staggered past his flashy car, and he knew, I could tell, that lately I'm literally killing myself with drink. Genuinely, I don't know where it comes from. The courtship is key. Gold. And I'm dying in this town. I'm lost. I've never had a woman. But I know there are days that can lift you and cleanse you if you're ready. that's in that way where you're kind of keeping your eye out and keeping your ear out for a new poem. I seem to have had a lot of luck with elderly ladies over the years, and I got lost on my way from Galway to Cork today, and went through the town of Adair, and went past it by about 5 or 6 miles, and got confused, and had to do the very embarrassing thing of going into a garage to find out how to get to Cork. And I went in, and the first thing that struck me was that there were three very busy women working there, and all three of them were, I would say, at the least, in their mid-70s. Two of them, I think, were much older than that. And they were flying. So, to be polite, I went up to the checkout, and I bought a bar of chocolate. When I paid for the chocolate, I said, "Can I ask you two questions?" She said, "All right," kind of suspiciously. And I said, "Am I going in the right direction for Cork?" She said, "You're not." "That's one question." I said, "I probably need to go back that way, do I?" She said, "Yeah." I said, I have a second question as well. She goes, "Go on." I said, "Is there a post office nearby?" She goes, "Yep, you'll meet one in the village." "Grand, okay, thanks very much." I was embarrassed. I turned, I was going out of the shop, and one of the other elderly ladies firing away, stacking shelves, I asked her, "Did they have a toilet?" And she, much friendlier, said, "We do, absolutely. You just go around the back, around to the right." And as I was going out the door, I heard this voice following me out, and it was, "That's three questions." It's fantastic. It was a little gift. I didn't bother sticking around to give her cheek, but I was grateful to her all the same. This poem came out of an encounter not dissimilar to that, really, but kind of stopped in my tracks by an elderly lady. But the story is fairly straightforward in the poem itself. And the poem is called The Joy of Cards. I'm 94, but I tend to say that I am younger by 10 years. It quells the astonishment of some. Twice every week, I travel by bus to play cards in Cricklewood. I wouldn't have this rhythm questioned, and I don't like being reminded that perhaps I should be frailer than I am. If doubt occurs, I picture time. There's nothing surer than time's love. In the joy of a card night, it's there. Hosts of summers summoning me still. And, anyway, it's far too easily felt these days that one has lived too long. I'm in my 80s, I say. My tone informative, cautiously warm, into the ear of whoever is curious. No echo of what this world makes of life. This one was called Death and the Post Office. The job they're given is fairly simple. Find the place, go in for half an hour and discuss the settlement. Consider, if it's appropriate, the few antiques. The safe, the signs, the switchboard. Glance at the books, the electrics. Perhaps fill out some forms, but these owl ones, these Kathleen's, these Annie's, they can be fierce long-winded. For some of our lads, their ways are just too compelling. Some accept a drink, some will have lunch. We'd a Polish guy who took a 92-year-old out in the van. She showed him a ball alley. Fair enough, dozens of ghosts and no graffiti, but if you're not direct about the job, you understand we've had to weed out the dreamers. Immunity to stories, I find, is the primary quality. You don't want to be sitting at an old table under a clock that strikes you as fabulously loud, or find yourself cradled by the past, thinking a man need venture no further west than the brink he meets in the mouthful of milky tea. If the archive harbouring frailty of the postmistress soothes you, if her wit grants you the lost farm and maternity of the world, if her isolated, dwindling village, a place without a pub or a shop, whose nearest decent-sized town is itself desperately quiet. If these things move you, what I mean is, if you can't meet a forgotten countryside head on and calmly dismantle her, fold her up, carry her out, and ship her back to head office, however ambiguous, however heavy-handed or fateful, however bloody poignant the whole affair might seem to you, if you can't stand your ground when a steep moment of hospitable chat and reminiscence might tempt you to put your mobile phone on silent, or worse, blinded by plates of fruitcake to switch it off completely. If you cannot accompany an inevitable change, knowing you did not cause these people, these ways, to vanish, and if you will not sign off on expired things for us, then I'm sorry, but you are not our man. This poem is called The Plot. Better keep this in my hand, my throat is letting me down a little bit. Yeah, that's it. The Plot. There was a plot to keep her in Dublin. An edgy team of Anne's former boyfriends, we met for drinks and fed each other's need to pin her down this time and make her see. County Sligo, we'd heard, was in her mind, and none would underestimate the draw. Sligo, with those wide butter-armoured dunes, those valley-brained, summer-defying lakes, where nature waves self meteorologically, and Donegal eagles mark Nordic time. All this mirrored Anne's personality. We cursed her need of peace and drank her health. But our sad friendships were subjective prey to the drug of being Anne's man once again. And so it came to nothing, except this. She left us. Sligo won. She farms there now. But today, a primal photo in the Times. A juvenile fox held in Anne's long arms. I read entrancedly and gazed and wept upon the organic face of endless love. I'll read three short poems together, partly as a way of trying to sweet talk my own throat into settling down. That long journey today, I think the dry air in the car has left me with a tickle. I know that many of you write yourselves, and that experience of coming up with a new word or a particular image that's haunting you, and you're not quite sure when it's going to fit into your work, but you carry it around anyways. And I had this word, mermaidism, for a year or so, kind of a guilty satisfaction, a bit like a pun that you dare not share. or that you won't share until you find the right people. So this word, mermaidism, and I think that the very eccentricity of it caused a delay in it finding a home. I thought it was going to end up in a piece of fiction, but the novel that I'm completing at the moment does have a group of sisters called the Donnellys, and within the book there is a small town fascination with the beauty and the talent of these women. So this poem, in a way, is about that fictional family that I've been living with for the last number of years, writing the book, and it is as I say, a short poem, and it is the poem where that wonderful new phrase, that catchphrase, even that brand, mermaidism, found its home. The Donnellys. Someone, in an accent of seduction, whispered salmon. Then someone filled a bucket up with sleep. Mermaidism in the Donnelly house was five sisters deep. Another short poem. This poem is called Remedia Amoris, which means the cure for love. Remedia Amoris. In reaching past the loss of love, both hands play their part. One to jettison old hope, one to close the heart. This is called Matchmakers. He once walked into a room where daughters and aunties were drinking. No one called out, "Lead with your womb," but some made it clear they were thinking of families forged half by guile and half by great hammerings of guff. The room reclined with a smile, but the flirting that followed was rough. There are a number of sonnets in maiden names, and I'm going to read two of those now. Patrick Kavanagh once described the sonnet as the envelope of love, and neither of these sonnets are about love. So, because I like that notion, that definition very much. When I think about these poems, I think of them as kind of deviant in some way. So you can make up your own minds. apologies if you do, if you are very much attached to the romantic idea of the sonnet. Margaret and Tony. We'd been wondering, and then a text explained. Affairs on both sides, wedding off. But then that night it was all back on. The same sister revealed, they're both gutted, but marrying still. If you knew Margaret and Tony, you'd appreciate what a fine circle ours was to roll with their guff. Both consistently bullied their confidants. Both were volubly prudish, obstreperously vain. We were a fine circle, but not so absolute in our friendships as not to welcome the valve of this misfortune. And so we texted each other furtively for days. Astounded, either had found another to bear the hooves of their personality, and thrilled the big day now would have such themes. This poem is called Independence. Independence. His mother and his sisters gave up on him in his 40s. There were admirers in the town, opportunities in Galway and Dublin, yet doggedly he built his vintage solitude. And even in the years when the odd echo of his origins could reach him still, in the dawn of his middle age loneliness, he persevered. Suicide spoke, but he had the same deafness ready. Lately though, at night, his blood gathers itself against that will. It ladles across his mind an early vanity. Memories of being wanted. Memories, some fictive, of being silver-tongued. While his heart, a kind of fox, climbs down to the lake and begs the dark to strike or bless the cottage. Thanks very much. This next poem is called Huckleberry Finn Day, and I was asked to come on board and write a piece in support of a fundraising event called Huckleberry Finn Day about 6 years ago. And the idea was that the charity was going to organise for hundreds of people to canoe down the River Moy in County Mayo and stop at a little island and get to do some archery, and back into the canoes and the rafts and everything, and it was an insurance nightmare, and it was impulsive and it was a crazy idea, but it worked very well for 2 years, but only by virtue of the fact that the one person at the centre of it was driving it, calling in the favours, being extraordinarily imaginative and unreasonable at the same time, and he was the guy who asked me to come on board and write the piece, and I had this preconception that I would write, okay, rivers, and that's a I can dig in there. I'll go for some nature mysticism maybe, or I'll write about pike. But spending a little bit of time with him and getting on board and kind of being intoxicated by his energy, as many of the other people were who were offering their services, I found myself zoning in really on that idea of a big project that should not work, but somehow does. And the poem mentions the River Moy. It also mentions a lake area called Pontoon, and it mentioned a small river called Guichin, and these are all bodies of water in County Mayo. The rest is self-explanatory. And it's called Huckleberry Finde. Huckleberry Finde. The pike swims under the otter, and the otter dives into the moon, and the moon grows young with the unfound girls forever. I should say that they were fundraising for water safety, for better amenities and better emergency response on the rivers. Right? That's an important thematic thing. I meant to say that at the beginning. So that's the refrain. The pike swims under the otter, and the otter dives into the moon, and the moon grows young with the unfound girls forever. The fundraiser's handbook gives it to you straight. Rule number one, be bullish with your inspiration. With the bigger events, you'll always be laughed at, but they have to laugh. This is widespread generosity we're talking about, the most abundant element and the least available. Laugh with them and plow on. The initial response must always be ignored. Behind the trees, inside the hills of the initial response, that is where the cave of warm donations lies. Rule number one, be bullish with your inspiration. The pike swims under the otter, and the otter dives into the moon, and the moon grows young with the unfound girls forever. Rule number two, hold this like the body of a lover in your mind's eye. Widespread generosity. Widespread generosity. When it's a water safety gig, believe that the names of the rivers involve every human life. Imagine the search and recovery man as the patron saint of those blunt mid-40s drinkers who once were diamonds in the scouts. Believe, if you enter a pub, armed only with a white bucket, chanting Moy, Pontoon, and Guichin, Moy, Pontoon, and Guichin, with this as your only message, that still you'll be showered with coins, because the idea of rivers, well put, corners a man's nerves, prods the core of his apathy, and prods his boyhood until he's pledging his support. Digging deep at the bar, suddenly hit by the knowledge of the cold search and the cold recovery, and reckoning then in his gut that the search and recovery man is the patron saint of the life buoyancy of selflessness. Rule number two, hold this like the body of a lover in your mind's eye. Widespread generosity. Widespread generosity. The pike swims under the otter, and the otter dives into the moon, and the moon grows young with the unfound girls forever. Rule number three, as if your life depended on it, have mugs and t-shirts printed. The search and recovery man is the patron saint of fresh clothes and hot, sweet tea. Absorb an image of the men that crawl in black currents, prodding at muck, asking the swollen river, where have you taken the piece of life we cannot hope you'll respect, river? Snake-mirrored, stone-stomached, self-tunneling river, where is the memorial woman you've held since the old bridge straddling you dropped her? When it's a water safety gig, include this spirit. Coil it into a logo for the merchandise, with the green angel of the bulrush and the red angel of the raft. When widespread generosity is woken between the towns and a crowd goes down to the river, alive to the notion that the search and recovery man is the patron saint of women giving birth to hundreds of sandwiches at the drop of a hat, give them something to wear and something to drink from. The logo will bloom when the canoeists are paddling against the tug of the loss that has prompted your vision and called you to live by rule number three, as if your life depended on it. have mugs and t-shirts printed. The pike swims under the otter, and the otter dives into the moon, and the moon grows young with the unfound girls forever. The pike swims under the otter, and the otter dives into the moon, and the moon grows young with the unfound girls forever. Very much. I'll conclude by reading a Horace poem in tribute to this Michael Klein, Michael Quain sculpture, which I was hearing about earlier on. It's an extraordinary thing, an extraordinary mascot for Leo Vale Knight, I think. This poem is called In There, and I'll read it by way of concluding, and thanks all very, very much for your kind attention. In There. The swollen mare, an animate hillside dolman, was the warmest thing in the field. In the rain, we approached her with the vet, who would insert his arm into the tight cave of her life. Under her tail, in there, where I imagined tongues of braille flesh spoke things on his hand that my parents paid him to translate. And I could not imagine her insides as dark. I thought there had to be something there, clearer than daylight. The stuff and the place so profound to be said of, life comes from. She groaned, but stood still, an inconvenienced yet tolerant oracle in our inquiring midst. Sunk to his shoulder in hot equine encasement, the vet fixed his eye on the distance and read. And then, the checkup complete, his sheathed arm glistening with the grease of horse health, he smoked and spoke to my parents. With the sight of the mare's soaked oak neck, big veins there like suede worms, my eight-year-old mind pulsed. Her mane of treacle laces, her bulbous, inky eyes, maternal in ways that made me feel safe and sad. Drizzle drifted through, her steam from her body met our visible breaths. Two clouds of creaturely presence diffusing together in February light. Pleased, we descended the hill. My ankles weak upon the hoof craters, the Lilliputian castles of manure unmade by Mayo weather. The rain falling steadily upon the ocean of sympathy that was that sacred word, full. Thanks very much.